Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, we got Intel's Optane H10 benchmarks. Do you want it in your next laptop? VR update, Oculus Quest, and Rift S? Well, you can get both for half the cost of Valve's Index Ring, the Athena Silent Computer, and Samsung's Portrait Mode TV. All that more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 515, recorded on May 2nd, 2019. Samsung's vertical reality and VR headsets. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twitch. And by Gazelle, the trusted online marketplace for buying and selling used devices. Visit gazelle.com/twit to buy a certified pre-owned device and get 10% off your purchase. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most informative, and occasionally most frustrating, and not this week, the most snarky, not this week, no snark, these most snark-free news and reviews and PC hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined by Mr. Sebastian Peek of PCPer.com, who does not have the hollow-eyed look of a survivor of episode 3 of Game of Thrones or someone that's been benchmarking for the last 24 hours. So either you're hiding it or you're not in benchmarking trauma right now.
I'm not in benchmarking trauma, and I'm more than 50% snark-free this week, probably 51 to 52%. Uh-huh.
That's alarmingly snark-free for you. Alarmingly.
Which would be the nearly 5 hours of sleep I got last night.
The joys of having a young child. We're going to talk about the festival of VR rigs, or headsets more accurately, that are coming out. Will have either been announced this week or orders have started this week, will be available this month or later. But you wanted to get a little bit deeper on Intel's Optane H10 solid state storage, which was announced with the festival of mobile and desktop parts we talked about last week. Nobody had really gotten too hands on with them. That said, how are you feeling about it at this point?
It's difficult to benchmark, and
we talked about that last week.
I was struggling at that point, and I finally just said, all right, I've got to put something out on this because I could just sit on it forever. So I accumulated what I had and put out just a quick review. A more in-depth review that I saw that's quite comprehensive is the one from Anand Tech. Their storage editor put it through its paces and really probably a little bit more aggressively than they needed to, because they have their own storage bench suite, and they have a heavy and a light. They also have what they call the Destroyer. And in the Destroyer, which I think is the page before the one we're looking at on the video, it's just kind of ludicrous. But because of the nature of this drive, it's literally two drives in one. And if you didn't listen last week, we were talking about this briefly. The Optane H10 is literally two separate devices sharing one PCB. And each of them has a PCIe Gen 3 by 2, and they're not bridged or anything. This is not being controlled with some sort of firmware controller, not any kind of software RAID on the device. It's all controlled in software on Windows. So you have to install either Intel's Optane software or Intel's SSD toolbox. Either of them will let you configure this. And it actually shows up as two separate devices in the Windows disk management console as well. So you could, if you wanted to, format and use a 32 gigabyte Optane module and a 500 gigabyte SSD. And there's another kind of interesting aspect to this, which is that the SSD portion of it has an SLC cache, similar to what we've seen with SSDs like the Evo series from Samsung, or even though this one's actually using QLC, unlike some of Intel's mainstream drives like the 760P series, which I believe are TLC, and triple level cell. This is quad level cell, so a little bit slower performance. However, a portion of it, and they don't specifically mention what that portion is, I would assume it's somewhere between 16 and 32 gigabytes, operates in SLC mode. So it's performance, it's raw performance, really depends on how big the file transfer is that you have going. And where mm-hmm. Optane excels is in ultra low latency, like really, really small files. And it's really fascinating to get into this. And I kind of briefly summarized some of the findings from our last exploration of Optane at the website when Alan Malentano was still here. And it's based on a technology called 3D XPoint. And I linked to the old review and kind of briefly covered some of Alan's findings. But 3D XPoint literally allows bit by bit, like in place, read-write cycles. So it doesn't work in page blocks. It doesn't work in kilobytes and megabytes like NAND flash does, where you have to erase an entire like megabyte block and have kilobyte blocks being written. You can actually go right in place and erase one bit of data and write one bit of data over it, which is what makes this so advantageous for really small reads and writes and just kind of basic everyday stuff like booting Windows, the kind of activity that actually, the kind of stress it puts on NAND is just completely different with 3D XPoint, which is very, very much like phase change memory, but they never called it phase change memory. But it all that being said, like you can read it. I was reading and getting fascinated by this topic and then actually using it and comparing this to like a top of the line NVMe drive, which just uses really fast flash and a fast controller and maybe some DRAM cache. It's totally workload dependent whether you're going to see a big difference with this or not. Just very briefly, the one really easy thing to point to is like reading or writing while another like file operation is going on. It's very good at file access during writes, for example. So there was a noticeable improvement with the H10 with its Optane cache enabled and configured. When I was trying to open up applications and I had some sort of file activity going on in the background, like copying a large file over in the background. So that sort of thing, that sort of multitasking that you might do on a laptop.
Or a desktop for that matter.
Yeah. I say laptop because as far as I know, initially this is only going to be offered on laptops. They sent an HP Spectre X360 13-inch Touch was the official test platform everybody got with this. And they said it would also appear in some small form factor. I'm guessing there will be some mini PCs that possibly offer this, but I'm thinking more all-in-ones, just any kind of space-constrained environment that only has one M.2 slot where this makes sense. Because if you have two, you could just get an Optane module if you wanted to add one to your existing SSD. But it's just a really interesting thing. It's an interesting idea, and it works as long as your board supports it or your laptop supports it. And right now, they're just working hand-in-hand with OEM. So I have no idea what the ultimate goal with this product is, if they're going to continue down this road and continue making these bifurcated drives, as they're known, because it's two separate drives, CP, or if this is like a stopgap because Optane is just prohibitively expensive. I mean, obviously, a 512 gigabyte Optane drive would be a lot faster. It has to fall back to that flash at some point. And the ultimate performance of QLC flash, once you've gotten past that SLC portion, is not tremendous. So if you look at the AnandTech review where they just hammer the drive, you can see initial, like really fast, like this thing can hit 2 gigabytes per second, but then over a sustained workload, it falls down onto that QLC flash and it's quite low in performance. It's closer to like an Intel 660p or lower, actually. And so anyway, just my own little mixed workloads and even running PC Mark and looking at like average application open times and that sort of thing, it was all faster with the Optane cache versus any other drive I tested, including a pretty fast Western Digital drive, the SN750, which is their Western Digital Black drive, which is about as fast as a 970 Evo. And it's not huge gains. You're not seeing like 100, 200 point increases, but you're seeing faster application load times and a little bit better in that sort of essential productivity category. So it's noticeable, but I would love
what's the price delta between like that Western Digital and the Intel H10 with the Optane memory?
That's unknown at this point. The only thing anybody's reported currently is price ranges that we're going to expect from OEMs. So, for example, like HP, we're hearing $800 or so for one of these laptops that includes the base model of this, which is 256 gigs, goes up $150 to the 512 model, which we tested. So laptops such as the HP could start at around $949 to $1,000 or so. So I just looking at that 150 jump between the 256 and 512, I was kind of estimating, well, what if this is like a $300-ish product if it was at retail right now, and then like the 256 one might be like 179, or, you know, I'm making things up, but it does completely depend on what the OEM wants to do as far as pricing. So if we actually see this come out as a consumer product, once like the next generation of motherboards come out and then all of them out of the box support bifurcated drives, then I think Intel might release it separately. I imagine that they're not doing it at this point just because they have to work so closely with the OEMs to actually make sure that this works properly.
It's always good when it works properly.
Yeah. I know a non-tech complained they had a Gigabyte board that had a BIOS update for it, but then the BIOS update didn't work properly, because it's one thing if it can see both drives separately. It's another thing if it actually enables the Optane cache with the software.
Right.
So they have to go through some validation to make that work. But
I mean, I think it's really, I still, we were talking about this last week. It's like, did they expect solid state prices to drop this fast? You know, I mean, maybe this is establishing a brand where, you know, Optane memory starts taking over some combination of storage and main system memory, or they just up the, you know, the performance on SSD, or more probably from an Intel perspective, would be kind of classic is they eventually build every, you know, get all Intel branded products or all products using the Intel processors, you know, using their storage permanently soldered to the motherboard, so that you have to buy a new laptop with a new processor and whenever you want to upgrade.
Vertical integration.
Yeah, don't get me started about Apple fighting against the right to repair bill in the state of California.
Hey, Patrick, might hurt yourself, and they're just concerned about you, okay? That those broken screens can cut you. I mean, that's why Apple.
That's what Kyle Weens pointed out at the founder of iFixit. Kyle pointed out that the only injuries he's seen repairing iPhones is when people, and, you know, I don't know if you've ever had a cracked iPhone screen and scraped a bunch of glass slivers into your face. That was good. I like that. If you're not watching the video, you didn't see my face shattered with 1,000 pieces and fall down and a truly disturbing wipe. Apple had sown enough doubt with vague and unbacked claims of privacy and security concerns. You know, so just when I'm thinking about moving back to the iPhone, Apple pisses me off so bad. I don't want to deal with them again. But their Apple's claim is that, there are lithium-ion batteries in phones and tablets and our laptops. And as we've seen, lithium-ion batteries can explode, and they're very difficult fires to put out, which is true, which is why Tesla is educating fire departments all over the country. If you don't know about how difficult it is to put out lithium-ion batteries, you should probably learn about that, and I hope you never have to deal with one. But it's really hard. You know, when you're using plastic spudgers and simple tools to poke enough of a hole inside of a lithium ion battery to get it lit on fire. I also like, there's a lovely article on ZDNet by Adrian Kingsley Hughes where they quote The Verge and Motherboard and several other places that have been writing about this. where he points, where they point out, he points out, if Apple is concerned about the safety of owners, especially those who want to go on the adventure of fixing their device, then surely a right to repair bill would give owners access to service literature, equipment, and parts to make things safer. Apple is also choosing to ignore all the other dangers associated with iPhone ownership, from accidental exposure to broken glass, electricity, unexpected fires, or walking out into traffic while distracted by a tweet or a meme. So, yeah. You know, it's you know, I this also may or may not be tied into the dip in sales of high-end smartphones and Apple's desire to keep revenue moving up and not just on services, or they don't want to lose Apple Care revenue or. But I will stop now. I believe in right to repair. I think you should be able to fix things to keep them out of landfills and dumps, and that, you know, the best way to recycle something is to keep using it for as long as possible. So, yeah. Good article summarizing this on The Verge, by the way, if you are curious about repairing things and keeping it going. But, yeah, I'm going to stop before I get all cranky and angry. remember smartwatches? Do you wear a smartwatch?
I wear a smart larch, yes. It is a large tree. Indigenous to UK, I believe. At least from my Monty Python education.
I was going to say.
I don't wear a smartwatch. I've thought about it. I've considered the most popular one, which we're about to talk about. But it's just one of those things where if I always have my phone in my pocket, I really question why I would need one, unless it was for some sort of health concern. And those features are getting more and more mature. So maybe.
Maybe. Well, it's I bring this up because sales have kind of exploded. Counterpoint Research did an article on this. And we haven't, you know, we kind of went a while with anybody other than Apple making any kind of smartwatch announcements, or maybe Fitbit. But 48% year-over-year growth in Q1 2019. And Apple's crushing it. One of every three smartwatches being sold is an Apple smartwatch. The analysts point out that the heart rate sensor for health monitoring, GPS, speedometer sensors for fitness, and NFC embedded for payment are some of the key integrated technologies. So, also notes that, quote, limited battery life remains a pain point for consumers' decision-making process, irrespective of region and price band, which is to say everybody's pissed off that they have to charge their watch every night. But it's crazy when you look at that chart right there from Counterpoint. 35.8% of all the smartwatches sold came from Apple. Samsung's up to 11.1%, Emu 9.2%, and Fitbit 5.5%. And then there's a long list, you know, Amazfit, Huawei, Fossil, Garmin, and a giant grab bag that accounts for another 28% of the sales. So, so they're out there.
And I see a lot of people wearing them. I'm not in the minority yet, I don't think, but there are more and more people that I know wear them and like them. And a lot of times I think all they're really using them for is a step counter and a notification alert when they get a text message or like a Facebook notification or something. But it's useful to them. It gets a little hairy when they're like connected and they're on your data plan. And I think that just the physical size limitations and the fact that they have to have like a nice, bright, legible screen make it very difficult to get battery life out of them. So the next evolution of battery technology, or, you know, maybe just the internal components shrink a little bit. Plus, some of them are even with limited battery life, an Apple Watch is pretty chunky. These are not really slim, svelte wristwatches.
I mean, I have huge wrists, so the Apple watches don't look too bad on my wrist. But occasionally I see one where it almost seems like the watch face itself is the size of the back of somebody's hand. For me, it was actually I couldn't fit the Apple Watch on my wrist until they came out with the extra large bands. And then I realized that, you know, the reason I stopped wearing wristwatches years and years and years ago is because I end up having wrist problems when I wear them. So I stopped again. I tried. I also stopped because I couldn't find anything useful with the first to do with a first generation Apple Watch. Tell you what is useful. Something I use every day is a VPN. And this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. You know, you may think that nobody cares about my stuff. I'm secure. Everything's good, right? You know, cybercrime is something that happens to other people, right? You know, nobody wants your data. Nobody can get your passwords. You know, you're right until you're wrong, and you're dealing with a whole lot of trauma and pain and frustration, especially, you know, you got a small business, you got a company. Stealing data from people that don't know what's happening on public Wi-Fi it's a way for some nasty people to try to make some money off of you in a really cruel way, which is essentially why I don't leave my internet connection unencrypted. And also because I just don't feel like sharing everything I do with my ISP. It's nice to be able to just not share the information. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data, hiding your public IP address. ExpressVPN is easy to use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, your phone, your tablet. If you can click a button, you can turn on ExpressVPN. And using ExpressVPN, I can safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or have my personal data stolen. It's an extra layer of encryption, right? You'd be like, oh, I'm talking to my bank over HTTPS. Everything's cool. Well, do me a favor. Put another layer. You know, wrap another layer of security around HTTPS. Just give yourself a little breathing room there. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/twitch for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/twitch to learn more. And we want to thank ExpressVPN for supporting This Week in Computer Hardware. You found information on Valve's Index VR headset. Yes. What is the Index VR headset? Is this a professional headset, a consumer headset?
As far as I know, it's consumer. I know there was a something else from Oculus, I think that was higher end, but this is Valve's high-end consumer VR kit. I believe it's the complete kit that costs you that $999. I want to say the actual unit itself is only $600, perhaps. Well, no, the headset is $500. The controllers are $279. The base station is $149. So all told, you put it together in a bundle and it's $1,000. And it's what kind of frustrated me about this is that it's the Lighthouse base stations that they're using. It's still going to require a tremendous amount of space. It's still expensive. But the tease was that Valve was saying there was going to be like a flagship game coming out, which they're not identifying. Ooh. To try to sell this as the killer app, which is, you know, obviously what VR has kind of lacked. I know there are people who have their favorites of what's out there, but there hasn't been that thing like you have to play this and you have to play it in VR that makes people go out and spend $500 to $1,000 on a headset and controller kit.
I mean, we were talking earlier about this being a relatively snark-free episode because apparently you're feeling very self-conscious about your snarkiness.
Well, perhaps.
But it has been interesting to see around, because the other thing that happened that kind of picked up speed this week was pre-orders for the Oculus Quest and Rift S. We'll talk about these in a minute. The next generation Oculus headsets started up this week. They'll be delivered, I think if you order today, you can still get one by like May 24th. But the amount of like, VR is dead, but there's these new headsets are like, oh, these are exciting new headsets. Not that anybody... And it's really interesting to watch the sort of VR enthusiast versus VR meh, you know, because there's been a lot of, you know, it reminds me of a much sort of shorter time span, but a similar experience where like 3D was going to change everything and this and that and the other thing and this is cool and those are cool. And you need 3D print the cat a new litter box, use it for everything. And then people started using 3D printers and they were like, yeah, this is... this is complicated and difficult and nothing shiny and painted the way it looks like in the advertisements or the website that I downloaded the model from. And then sort of things kind of slowed down. And it seems like with VR, there's a bunch of really good short games, but there's not a lot of really good in-depth stuff. There's a lot of good sort of like adrenaline-based Twitch stuff. I mean, there's two or three of them, you know, that I can play until, you know, I'm about to hyperventilate or have a heart attack. But for anybody who doesn't particularly, you know, get off on you are being crushed by increasing levels of mayhem and you know, firepower, or, you know, there hasn't been a killer title. There hasn't been a killer app. The art apps are pretty fantastic. But, there's been a sort of, is it chicken or the egg? Is it, do we need the killer app? Do we need more affordable hardware? The Index VR is obviously not super affordable for most people, right? But I thought it was interesting looking at the Oculus Quest and the Rift S pre-orders, right? You can pre-order one now. It's $398 for the Quest. Let me try that one more time. $399 for the Quest with 64 gigabytes of storage. Another $100 for 128 gigabytes of storage. And that's the standalone one that's based on a Snapdragon 835. The Rift S, which is their next generation Oculus VR that's going to require you to be tethered to a computer, that's selling for $399. So I want to point out right now that includes the controllers. Shipping begins May 21st. So I checked before the show. If you order one today, they're saying you'll get it by May 24th, which is, you know, says two things to me. One, that they're not selling a ton of these, or two, that they've really dug deep to make sure they have the manufacturing capacity. But it's nice to kind of sort of be able to order and receive your hardware that fast. So the Quest, like I mentioned, Snapdragon 835. You know, you kind of deal with it using the Oculus app on your iPhone or your Android phone. Full 6 degrees of freedom, which is fantastic as far as I'm concerned, because 3 degrees of freedom is so incredibly limiting when you're working in a VR environment. Again, as I mentioned before, it includes the controllers, uses Oculus Insight tracking, so you don't need any external devices. And the link I saw, and I feel like I want to look it up again, but the link I saw said 2880 by 1600 per eye, which just sounds insane.
That was the combined resolution of the new Valve headset.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that would be per eye on the...
It did not make sense to me. I mean, it's also interesting about the Verge. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say, think about the horsepower that would have to drive that kind of resolution. Because really, more resolution is great. Eliminate screen door effect entirely and have ultra-high resolution. But you have to have something to drive that resolution with every frame. And there's no way you're doing that on a Snapdragon 835. Adreno graphics are great, but they're not that great.
Yeah, and that's the other thing you're giving up is refresh rate, because refresh rate that I know is 72 hertz, which is fast enough, but not particularly impressive.
Baseline. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, it's 1440 by 1600 resolution to each eye. So
okay, that's not bad.
So that actually is right up there with the HTC Vive Pro. That's higher than the Go. That's higher than the Rift S. The Vive Pro is running at 90 hertz. The Rift S is running at 80 hertz. This is running at 72 hertz. USB-C charging for the Quest, 2 to 3 hours on a charge. So, again, as with so many things in life, batteries directly control the fun.
I just wanted to quickly quote the Verge write-up where they actually quote Polygon here. They said that during Valve's demonstration, a spokesperson said that Index, that's the new Valve headset for $1,000. Index is the sort of thing that is likely to appeal to a virtual reality enthusiast who A, must have the latest thing, and B, enjoys sufficient disposable income to satisfy that desire. Like, well, isn't that the target, like the ultimate target demographic for any new product? We want this to appeal to the people who have to have it and are willing to pay whatever we're charging for it. That's our business plan.
I mean, you know, PC Mag's had an early review. The Verge has an early review. Inside Out Tracking is working well. Everybody loves that it's tetherless. Everybody loves that Oculus has so many of the best VR games. you know, again, as you pointed out, graphics horsepower is just not there compared to a desktop PC. And it's still a little grainy on the screen. So everybody seems to like it.
I think that the standalone idea is a better one. As even though I'm the PC, uh-huh. you know, hardware reviewer side of things.
Right.
The idea of being tethered physically or dealing with added latency or complexity from some sort of a wireless setup, just putting on a headset that already has taken advantage of like modern graphics horsepower, CPU compute horsepower from a smartphone platform,
right.
and just literally have like 6 degrees of freedom without having to have like pillars around you in the room and have like a dedicated 10 by 10 foot space. Like if it actually lets you do it within your normal habitat and it doesn't require any external wires or anything and it has decent battery life, then it'll continue to get better. Like the hardware will catch up and you'll get faster refresh rates and higher resolution. But what do you think is the category that will actually finally drive this? Like, is it role playing? Like, think about the World of Warcraft phenomenon. What if right. WoW had been VR only? I don't think it would have been as big, but people probably would have gone out and bought VR headsets to play the game.
You know, it seems like the one company that's really winning right now is Sony with their VR stuff for the PlayStation. Because, you know, they know what their gamers want. They develop to their gamers. It's relatively, actually extremely affordable compared to some of the options that were out at the same time. I think some sort of crazy, massively multiplayer stuff. I feel, we'll use feeling words in the group, I feel that the killer application probably doesn't exist yet. Because a lot of the stuff right now is super, you know, I think when you get the idea of something like a Quest and a group of people either in the same locale or at distant places being able to interact and stuff, if you're watching the video, you're seeing some terrifying boxing and some other games, but... I'm kind of curious to see what it's developing. I'm also kind of excited because I can actually, save enough milk money to buy one of these. Whether or not I will, it's tough. I want to hopefully get a chance to play around with both of them at some point. I have the horsepower to run the Rift S, but the idea of not being tethered a la the Quest is definitely much more attractive to me.
I just want to walk around the streets of Los Angeles and be a Blade Runner, you know, with really convincing graphics. That's another thing. The VR games that I've played, like Office Simulator and other things, like back a few years ago, it looked like a Nintendo Wii, like, or GameCube level graphics, but it was kind of interesting and it was novel. I want to feel like I'm really somewhere else, and we're not there yet, unfortunately. Like, just
no
alternate realities, like a simulated holodeck, which is what's been driving this for a long time, but nowhere near that point yet.
They're going to be a lot closer on the Rift S than you are going to be with the Quest, but then again, you'll be tethered. Yeah, I'm trying to think what else to say, but at this point, it's, it's kind of like a lot of the same games, a lot of the same use cases. I don't know. You pre-order one for review at PC Per, or are you holding off?
I did not. I mean, if they wanted to send one for review, I would check it out, but no, I did not pre-order one.
So... we didn't get one either.
Yeah.
The event was like over
there. I'm
not
on that list, unfortunately.
Well, you're on good lists. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Gazelle, the trusted online marketplace for buying certified pre-owned devices. I love keeping old electronics at landfills. You can see me hammering on my hand. I was talking about it earlier. You set your creative, your professional goals. If you don't have the right tools to tackle them, they can be so hard. And if you've been looking to upgrade your devices, you should definitely be thinking about Gazelle. They give you a ton of options. As somebody who buys a lot of used stuff off Craigslist, you know, people have some really interesting ideas of what, brand new means. And, Gazelle, they got a pretty good system put down.
Devices are available in fair, good, excellent conditions. The prices are great. Everything from the iPhone 6 through 10, a bunch of Samsung Galaxy phones. They have MacBook Airs. They have MacBook Pros. They have iPads. They have all the iPads, standards, Air and Pro. Every device they get in goes through a thorough 30-point inspection. They're backed by a 30-day return policy. There's no restocking fee, and the shipping is free. So this is really a risk-free way to check things out. All their products are sold without a carrier contract. They're all available. Support by major carriers are unlocked. And they even have financing available. They use Firm. You can get it instantly approved and pay off in 3, 6, or 12 months. You just select financing with a Firm at checkout, and you are good to go. Love this, right? Because these are all devices. They're being kept out of landfills. They're being kept out of the drawers. You know, if you have older devices, you might even consider seeing if Gazelle wants to buy them. It's an incredible selection of quality pre-owned devices. They're also an excellent choice for students. If you don't know, and you don't have to go running around all over your city or town to try to see what somebody claims is an iPhone in excellent condition, and then find out it's got a broken screen or they've scratched their initials in the back. Brand new, except for my initials and that broken screen. True story. Check out Gazelle for competitive offers on your used phones, tablets, or computers if you got old devices you need to get rid of. Level up, people, with new tech from Gazelle. Visit gazelle.com/twit to buy a certified pre-owned device and get 10% off your purchase. That's gazelle.com/twit, and we want to thank Gazelle for their support. I did a funny review on Tech Thing this week, and I'm going to pop it up there. What's the last like silent PC you played around with?
Silent? I've just some mini PCs. I think the last one was like from a small company on Amazon, and ECS has sent like every iteration of the Leva fanless PCs. It's almost always the same. It's like an Atom processor with some sort of extremely small enclosure that's smaller than an Intel Nook. And just passive cooling.
So on taking this week, I got an email a few weeks ago from Athena Computer. They said, we got a silent computer running elementary OS. Do you want to check it out? And I'm like, yes. Yes, I do. And the so if you scroll down, they have lots of lovely graphics on their page. Hit shop now. Hit one more time. And you're looking for that right there. That is the enclosure they use for the Athena computers. They've got Core i3 and Core i5 versions. And that is a Streecom DB4 fanless chassis. And what makes that really interesting, it's a big fat cube, duh. It's all made out of aluminum, which you may not be able to tell, or you can't tell if you're not watching the video. And they use a system, they basically suspend the motherboard vertically inside of the enclosure, and you can run heat pipes, or they run, obviously. You don't have to build this computer if you're buying it from Athena, but that Streecom DB4 chassis has optional heat pipes, so you can actually cool a not just your CPU or your GPU, and it actually runs it out to the sides of the enclosure. Some basic options. You're in the ES. I think if you're watching the video, you're looking at the EOS 5 version right now, and that's fairly loaded out. Like the one that Kevin just picked out is, I don't know, probably like a $2,500 machine with 32 gigabytes of RAM and 4 terabytes of SSD. We looked at the entry-level Athena EOS 3, and that's got like a 8th-gen Core i3 8100, a mini ITX motherboard, a GTX 1050 GPU, 8 gigs of RAM, and a 512 gigabyte SSD. It's not inexpensive, right? Part of that is that case alone, if you're buying it retail, is about $300 without adding any additional cooling in there. But I will say, I was running a full multi-core Intel desktop processor, admittedly a Core i3, not a Core i5, but it'll diffuse the heat from a Core i5 without having any noise. And as I can hear a fan that's going on my computer over here, but I was laughing. I mean, one of the things I talked about in the review on Tech Thing is, you know, the trade-off for having a silent PC is to spend more money because fans are cheap, and all of the engineering it takes to make things move heat from your processors without making any noise are a little more expensive. It was also interesting because it's running elementary OS, which is a flavor of Linux based on Ubuntu.
that has certain resemblances to OS X, I think. It is actually a really nice way if you want to give someone who you know is not going to become a Linux nerd but could use a free operating system. Open source people are kind of back and forth about elementary OS because they have sort of a selection of curated apps they post before the regular apps or some other stuff that I won't get into because it's super inside baseball. And I'm not conversant enough in the community to not get myself into trouble. But they do a very stripped down version of Linux that they limit the number of options you have, which makes it much harder for you to get into trouble by clicking on things you shouldn't. And it's slim, it's clean, it looks gorgeous. And it was really impressive. And that's available free. They have a sort of a pay what you want policy over at Elementary OS, which if you like developers to eat, and I do, you should pay them something, but you can still download it for free. It was interesting. I also got called out for slagging on Linux gaming because apparently there's a whole aspects of Linux gaming that have gotten better that I need to investigate. But, you know, if you're used to Windows, Linux gaming can be a little disappointing. Core i3 with 8 gigabytes of RAM is $1,550. A Core i5, which their configuration system gives you a minimum of 16 gigabytes of RAM and a 1 terabyte SSD. These are also with discrete GPUs, like 1550s, are going to set you back about $2,050. Not cheap, but as I mentioned before, silent PCs generally are not. And I'm going to give a shout out. So athenacomputer.us is the website.
So. It's like the evolution of the next cube. And everyone knows that, you know, Steve Jobs hated noise. That's why they came out with that terrible G4 cube that I think most of them failed. Or like the Macintosh 2, or was it, no, it was the Apple 3.
I don't think most of them failed.
So the Apple 3 initially had such bad problems that they literally phone support told you to lift up your desktop and drop it to hopefully reseat the chips that had worked their way loose because of so much heat built up inside the case. But
That wasn't because it was a cube.
I'm liking the video here. They're actually using it as a kettle, like for a workout.
This it does look like a kettlebell. Solid looking
enclosure. Yeah. That's fantastic. It does.
Oh, that's just horrifying. Even I didn't drink raw eggs in high school. I put raw eggs in my terrible oatmeal milkshakes. Moving onward. Moving on from raw eggs, let's talk about raw storage. Western Digital is preparing a 4 terabyte consumer SSD.
Yes.
Can we afford it?
Well, the estimates so far are around $500. I would hope to see that drop. Western Digital, with their Blue Series, they target pretty aggressive price points.
They
so
do.
I would not be surprised if this shows up on Amazon for like $50 below MSRP or something. But especially towards the end of the year, like once we get into the Black Friday and Cyber Monday type stuff, this will be cheaper. But just the idea of, you know, having 4 terabytes. I mean, 4 terabytes has only been in consumer hard drives for just a couple years, it feels like. I know that the NAS drives have been well above that for a while, but a Western Digital Blue spinning hard drive at 4 terabytes is a fairly new creation of the last couple of years. And they're cramming a lot. This is what, you know, the promise of 3D NAND was. This is SanDisk 64-layer 3D TLC NAND. It's not using the ultra-dense 96-layer flash, but this is the more mature 15-nanometer 3D stuff. And just, you know, it's a SATA SSD. They're talking 530 megabytes sequential writes, 560 reads. That's using an SLC cache as well. And there's obviously plenty of room for it with this much flash. So
all I can think of is if you're looking for, you know, this isn't, you know, compared to, you know, 2 terabyte hard drives last year, this is incredibly cheap. You know, if you've been looking for like, oh, I have a movie server and it takes forever for the movies to load, something like this is going to allow you to say, you know, open up your Blu-ray rips or open up, you know, your files considerably faster and just have a ton of storage relatively cheap. I'm kind of down with that.
Yeah, we've seen really big, slow SSDs before. I think on our podcast, it was like 2 weeks ago, Jim was talking about the really big, slow, like, I think it was Micron might have put this out. It was just like an enterprise, like, storage drive, but they were using one as a Steam, like a Steam cache on the network. And there's like a 2 terabyte version that's not very expensive. They're slow. I mean, they don't have really good access times. Like, you're not getting amazing IOPS or even especially like saturating the SATA for sequentials, but it's just a ton of storage that's still significantly faster than using an SSD. So it does speed things up if you're doing something like that. Like, if this was like serving something that you needed faster
right
access
now.
To. But yeah.
Yeah, and it's, we laugh, right? It's just like, you know, NVMe access times are so much better in IOPS, but, you know, if you're still running a rotating hard drive, an old school hard drive, it is still life changing to go to even the slowest SSD. And I want to be as, I want to be as hyperbole free as possible, generally speaking. But, you know, putting an SSD in somebody's system, if they're still running a regular old Winchester hard drive, will just be the like, oh my God, it starts faster, things load faster, everything is better. That and more memory. But I'm excited. Go Western Digital.
And then the very sad thing is when you see like a network attached storage device that takes advantage of like M.2 SSD caching. Or even you could populate it with SSDs like this. And then it's limited to like a gigabit connection. And so, 100 megabytes per second. Tremendous.
Oh, my goodness. You found a tera of just a... this hurts me.
I know what you're talking about.
Remember how we were talking about being snark-free in this episode?
TV. Yeah. Let's throw that out the window and let's talk. Let's give some frank talk about a real problem. And let's talk about vertical video. I'm not going to go Tom Cruise on you and talk about frame interpolation, but just as a PSA for anybody watching, if you see someone that you love taking vertical video, tell them to take their phone and turn it horizontally. They'll thank you for it later. And maybe you have to play around with it, because maybe halfway through the video wasn't the right time to turn. There we go. To turn the video, but going the wrong way. But you can fix it in software later, but there's nothing you can really do about a vertical video. Like those Instagram videos. I know that certain artists like Taylor Swift, I think last year, released a vertical music video, and it only worked properly if you're using like the Instagram app, I think. YouTube is black bars on the sides.
If you're Taylor Swift, you can do that, yo. It's a good read up at Fast Company, because the authors, I feel like they are being sarcastic in a very subtle way, but actually they're not. They're just.
I like that it's called. I want this insufferable TV for millennials. Like, fine, I'll take it.
If you can't see the video, what you're looking at is a screen oriented in the vertical position, or what we used to call the portrait mode. And this is the vertical, a new 43-inch TV from Samsung. Apparently, it's going to cost a healthy and outrageous $16,000.
I hope that's not in American dollars. Like, it's a 43-inch TV on a swivel mount. I'm pretty sure there are computer monitors that can do that now for like $1,500. Maybe not 43 inches, but you know, $200 monitors have tilt and swivel.
Well, mounts. If you do use one of the social networks that pushes vertical video, this will give you the chance to watch it massively without the big bars on the right and left side. I don't know what else to say about this. It's
You and I know a little bit about home theater and about, you know, people who use projectors and screens. And there's an entire market for like the convertible, like having a projector that has a preset for your anamorphic, like your ultra wide, and then your 16:9. And there are people who go all out and they get curtains and actually, like, you know, they cover the sides if they're not watching a CinemaScope, like a 2.35 or 2.4:1. And it's just, I would rather see something like LG's TV that like retracts down into a box. Maybe just have it like retract a certain way for widescreen presentations and move itself somehow for a vertical orientation. But this is literally just a swiveling 43-inch display. And it's useful. I've seen vertical TVs used in like offices and obviously in airports and things, because that's how it more effectively displays a lot of content. But just turn your phone horizontal and you don't need to worry about this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so as you start digging into more of this, there's the Serif and the Cero and the Frame. And we've seen Samsung Frames at CD and other places. That's actually pretty cool. They create a decent LCD flat panel. They have curated art for them. It looks really good. And they have a bunch of frames that go around them. That's actually, if you are not scope locked on having the best image possible, and or you want to put a television in a room where you don't want the television to dominate when you're not watching video, it's a fantastic device. The Cero, you flip it over, you know, vertical, it'll actually mirror your phone. And so you can play all those apps on there. It's got a 60-watt 4.1 channel speaker setup. It's interesting because I'm looking at 18.9 million won, and you know, it's depending on yes, 1,162.79 Korean won to $1. I'm getting $16,254 UFS, which I feel must be some kind of an insane typo.
It feels high to me. I'm not sure I would pay $16,000 for a 43-inch TV in 2019. But hey, that reminds me of that 10-inch, like 10.1-inch Sony OLED for $10,000 a number of years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I like the Serif too. It's kind of looks like a sort of a vintage display on a set of mid-century modern legs, and that's actually pretty stylish. But yeah,
they're doing the lifestyle thing. I mean, if you've got the money for it, they can enhance your vertical lifestyle, I guess.
I just feel like that price is driving me nuts. And probably also me looking that up over and over again is probably driving the audience nuts. So
we should talk about another ridiculous, useless television while we're on the subject.
Yeah, Huawei. Huawei is having a tough time. They got the Honor 20 coming up soon. They're getting beat up, obviously, in 5G rollouts in the United States. There may or may not be Vodafone evidence that they're doing some curious stuff. Huawei says, like, those are normal tools used for, maintenance. But 8K, 5G, and as you pointed out, quote, hopefully more buzzwords.
I don't think it's enough. Like, 8K is not enough, obviously. You know, it's a stopgap until we get to 16K. And that's just the way it is. And
I'm really not taking that bait.
And 5G is, it's going to be like the new Edge network. It's like the new GPRS. So I guess it's adequate. So if you're going to buy an 8K TV today, at the very least, make sure it's a 5G-enabled 8K smart TV from Huawei, who's never made a TV before. So I don't know if this is going to hit the U.S. market at all, and it probably won't, but I would also assume that it would be a little bit more than $16,000. Samsung's trying to impress us with that price tag. They're comparing this to Samsung's recently released Q900 8K television, which costs an eye-watering $70,000. Sony also has a $70,000 8K TV, but do they have 5G? That's what you have to ask yourself.
No.
It says a 5G TV could serve as a router for other devices as well. Well, I would hope so. It's $70,000 to $100,000. They would have some additional functionality, but, You can't have everything. Not when you're on the bleeding edge.
Yeah, anything involving networking and wanting a standalone device that isn't going to cost me a house down payment to replace.
Well, what if you got multiple Huawei 5G 8K TVs and used them in a mesh network? Sorry, I just talked over you for like 10 straight seconds.
No, I get the excitement of hoping to use your televisions as a mesh network and how that would drive you. I don't think it you know, and I'm
a lot more motivated to put a TV screen in every room than I am to, you know, put a router in every room. So why can't the TV be the router?
Well, on one hand, there's no reason not to, except that, you know, you will use it into, you know, will it be supported? Is it secure? Does it get updates? You know, what happens when new technology comes out? You need to upgrade your router. What happens if the router functionality becomes problematic? You know, the size of your house, you know, it pains me to realize that your house is actually a little bit smaller than my house, because my house is not even 1,200 square feet. You know, two mesh routers, blanket, literally from the far end of the backyard to out by the street, despite all the horsehair plaster and lath that my and Faraday material that my house is made out of. So, you know, you don't need one in every room. I don't know. I don't really, you know, given that I've been, given that I got into a knockdown drag out with Robert Heron a couple of years ago, basically telling him that it just stop. We just have to stop reviewing all of the apps built into television because they're all going to suck in 6 to 12 months, except for the stuff that's powered by the Roku. The Roku TVs are pretty good. Almost everything else, you know, is either like abandoned, ignored, poorly implemented, not supported in 2 years, or missing the application you want. So my running thing is like, get a Roku TV, get an Apple TV, don't rely on your television, and feel free to email if you have had wondrous and or tweet if you've had wondrous and joy-filled experiences with, you know, your television / blender / exercise equipment, or your you know, the applications that are built into your television. But more often than not, we find, even at some incredibly high-end televisions, that, you know, stuff never really got updated or didn't work particularly well, or just seemed so profoundly slow compared to standalone devices worked on by engineers who only cared about the standalone device. And, you know, where in the case of the applications and the operating system, it has more of an effort of like, we're going to have corporate independence and not use one of these other operating systems. But that means we have to develop everything. And turns out developing software is hard, even in a closed ecosystem. But I digress.
Plus, when the board for your TV has only one main processor on it, and it's having to do all of the visual processing that it does,
right.
And if you don't use things like frame interpolation, it is doing processing. And then you also have to share CPU cycles with some sort of rather complex on-screen interface that lets you navigate TV shows, and it's loading like larger images as you scroll, and having to load all the navigation and then just my TV is operating just fast enough to work properly, but then you start running apps on top of this interface, and it gets, you see dropped frames, you see a loss of like a smoothness, it's completely inconsistent refresh rate, and you navigate apps that don't make as much sense as they would on a dedicated device like you're talking about. Like Apple TV makes sense once you get used to the remote with its extremely limited buttons.
Right.
Once you get used to that kind of navigation. And then you go to a TV and you're like, oh, yeah, I remember what it was like to have to menu back three screens, find the exit Netflix button, and actually physically select it by like clicking the down arrow on the remote and then hitting the enter button to exit Netflix so that I can bring up the menu again and pick a different app to go into.
Right. So
navigating those things is kind of a nightmare. I don't, and then I know people who literally only use the built-in apps. And I had a Samsung TV that after about 2 years was useless, because like I wanted my MLB.TV app and then it didn't work anymore. And you start getting like notification warnings on the TV, like while you're using it, like support for, you know, such and such app ends in 3 months, or
right.
Ends May 29. You're like, what? I use that app. And then there's no replacement for it. So
why would you replace it? Oh my goodness. Yeah. You know, now you got me thinking about something I didn't add in this week that I should have is, Cisco is firing up, Wi-Fi 6 access points. And it's kind of crazy. Some reviews are starting to show up, and I'll be looking at them in the not exactly distant, but not exactly near future. But 802.11ax or the Wi-Fi 6, formerly known as 802.11ax, aka the next generation of wireless networking technology. There are, you know, we started seeing the router announcements at CES, but you know, at this point, Asus and Netgear and D-Link, I think, are all, well, Asus and Netgear are definitely shifting 802.11ax routers. I think D-Link's about to do one. And of course, my beloved Orbi will be coming with Wi-Fi 6 in the none too distant future. TP-Link is actually shipping their Archer AX 6000, which of course looks like a giant crown with eight antennas on it, I want to say off the top of my head. But I'm really curious to finally get some kind of laptop or standalone card and also look at some of the other stuff going on. We should probably talk about 802.11ax next week because there's some really interesting stuff. Excuse me, Wi-Fi 6, if you're watching the video. Because there's some interesting stuff going on in Wi-Fi 6 that's worth getting nitty and gritty on. Oh, my goodness. If this is your first episode of the show, you've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. We call it Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me over at a place called Tech Thing, TekThing, or the home theater and audio podcast I do, AV Excel, with Robert Heron. And if you are not familiar with the dulcet tones of Sebastian Peake, or the dulcet tones, as many people who actually can enunciate would say, you can find him over at PCPer.com, where he's the editor-in-chief and suffers all of the benchmarking pain. Well, not all of it, just all of the GPU and just CPU-based 90, stuff.
92% of it.
92%
like of it.
Thank goodness.
The next time you see us, the PC Per website, if we scroll through an article, will look very, very different. We experimented with this last night because the new site exists and is actually running on our dedicated hardware. We just haven't switched over the DNS yet, so we're learning back in. And it's going to look very pretty. It's going to be responsive for the first time. It's very strange to look in the preview and actually be able to choose, like, view it on desktop, view tablet mode, and here's what it would look like on a phone. Like, whoa, it's formatted properly for a phone.
It's crazy talk. Yeah, and hopefully the natural phone reformatting actually does what it's supposed to do. Yeah, good luck, sir. Rollouts are always terrifying.
I'm not doing any of the work. I'm just along for the ride.
You'll just be suffering the slings and arrows.
Exactly.
Climb up on the stagecoach with your 12 gauge. Oh my goodness, ladies and gentlemen, that's about it for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm going to set up a rundown for next week and put 802.11ax Wi-Fi 6 up near the top so we can talk about that. If you've got questions, do us a favor, tweet at Sebastian Peake or at Patrick Norton. We would love to talk to you about that and about anything hardware you're curious about. Desktops, mobile, phones, consoles, the Internet of Stuff. It's all under the rather broad umbrella we call This Week in Computer Hardware. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.